We've been exploring crime novels that tell you something about the cities where they're set. Today is the final installment of our series, Crime in the City. We go to an unlikely setting for a detective series, Laos, circa 1976, shortly after the communists took power. The protagonist is the country's coroner, a man in his 70s, and Dr. Siri Pyboon develops a special relationship with the dead. NPR's Michael Sullivan spoke with the author in the Laotian capital, Vientiane.
Colin Cotterill believes in fate, and fate seemed to determine early on that he would write the Dr. Siri books, though he didn't know it for quite some time. But it all made perfect sense to me after he led me down a narrow alley off Vientiane's Samsuntai Road and stopped in front of a faded five-story building.
This is the back of what used to be Vientiane Hospital. And when I first arrived in Laos, I was traveling with a doctor, and he leaned over to me and said, "Do you realize you have hepatitis?" I told him that that was ridiculous, and he sent me to the bathroom, and I looked in the mirror, and there was this big yellow creature staring back at me. So my first month in Laos was spent on the second floor of this building, and I was in isolation, being looked after by a large nurse who was very friendly, very helpful, and her name was Dui.
Nurse Dui is one of the three main characters in the Dr. Siri mysteries, and the real-life Nurse Dui helped persuade Cotterill to move into the hospital permanently after his recovery in an apartment above the operating room.
And there I stayed for 2 years as an honorary member of the medical staff, and I would pop down and watch them doing operations and visit the patients in the wards, and became very friendly with the doctors, and I got to learn about the Lao medical inadequacies firsthand.
Cotterill came to Laos on a project for UNESCO. He wanted to learn Lao. He already had Thai. So he began recording long interviews with just about everyone he met to work on his pronunciation. And in the process, he came away with fascinating stories of the years before and after the communist takeover.
Yes, unbeknownst to me, I was going to use them in books that I hadn't decided to write. So something psychological was happening that forced me to collect information, not knowing what to do with it.
He figured it out eventually, some 10 years later, after spending time as a teacher and running an NGO protecting children from sex offenders in Thailand. It was after that he finally decided to sit down and write about Laos.
You'd find Lao as extras in a novel talking about the Vietnam War, but you never saw the Laos people. And so what I wanted to do was to give them a voice and personality and feelings.
Those characters, Dr. Siri, Nurse Dui, and Mr. Gung, are drawn with sardonic humor. The sign over the door of Siri's office reads morgue in French. But the doormat, Dr. Siri's personal touch, says welcome in English. The place the author and I go to sit and talk is welcoming, too, and figures prominently in the first book, The Coroner's Lunch.
I imagine Dr. Siri having a room on this side of the house, overlooking the temple, watching the monks sweeping the leaves early in the morning. And I would be sitting on this balcony early in the morning writing my notes about the Dr. Siri series, interrupted by the sound of the gong from the abbot on the far side of the temple.
What makes these mysteries different, aside from the exotic location, is Dr. Siri's relationship with the dead. That is to say, his ability to see and converse with the dead, particularly the souls of the recently departed who end up in his morgue.
I didn't know this until after I'd written the book, but there are certain rules that you have to observe, and you're not allowed to cheat. You have to solve your crimes through the guile and common sense of a detective. Whereas Dr. Siri has clues from the beyond, which don't solve the cases for him, but which linger in his mind all the way through. He refers back to the clues that he gets, but he doesn't solve his mysteries through them.
A reluctant coroner and an even more reluctant communist whose nightly walks home only serve to remind him of the new regime's failings.
Siri walked back through the deserted streets. It was only 8 p.m., but Setatilat Road was as quiet as the grave. Only an unlit bicycle passed him on his way home. Small pyres of burned rubbish were smouldering on street corners. A rat emerged from a drain and chased a skinny cat through the portal of Ong Tư Temple. These were streets that used to ignore time. Clubs and bars that closed only when the last drunk fell out onto the street. Whores and addicts had littered the sidewalks. He'd heard about that other extremity, and here he was at this one. He couldn't bring himself to believe there wasn't something safe and joyful between the two.
Sadly, as Cotterill sees it, in modern-day Vientiane, that middle ground seems as elusive as ever.
This is not the Vientiane of Dr. Siri. This is a bar on a rooftop with a large screen television playing in one corner, six pool tables in the other, reggae music playing over the speakers, and attractive young ladies in short skirts sitting around waiting for an event for the evening. This is the same street that Dr. Siri would walk along on his way home to his house. He would be very disappointed. I think he would be disappointed, but he wouldn't be surprised.
The seedy nightlife is just one of Cotterill's laments about his and Dr. Siri's Vientiane. Cotterill is especially worried about creeping cultural imperialism from Thailand, just across the Mekong River.
Lao youth have a Thai culture. They watch Thai television programs and read Thai magazines. The girls wearing shorts and high-heel shoes and tank tops. And even in the 90s, that was unthinkable. Girls would be arrested for dressing like that.
And yet, for all his grumbling, Cotterill comes back several times a year to help manage the charities he helps run, to do research for his books, but mostly because he just can't help it.
I keep coming for the people and the heart. I keep coming because every time I come to Laos, something weird and wonderful happens. There's always the element of the mystical, that when I step off the airplane, I know something wonderful or something terrible is going to happen to me.
And in fact, had he not been kicked out of Laos in 1994, for reasons he can't explain, he's convinced he'd still be living here instead of Thailand, probably teaching and probably not writing mysteries.
We wouldn't have Dr. Siri. You wouldn't be sitting here beside me in the base of the Tat Dham Stupa, looking at the American Embassy, sweating ourselves to death in the midday sun because you sat us on the wrong side of the stupa in the sunshine.
Fair enough, but it was the quiet side. I had no choice, really. Fate. Michael Sullivan, NPR News.
And you can read a chapter from Colin Cotterill's latest novel, The Curse of the Pogo Stick, at npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
Over the next 2 mornings, we'll be looking at two writers who explored and explained what it feels like to be African-American in the United States. Richard Wright wrote his most famous books, Native Son and Black Boy, in the 1940s. Walter Dean Myers is writing about being young and black today, which leads to a story explored by NPR's Juan Williams. It's the way that one generation of black Americans tells its stories to the next.
This is how Richard Wright described where he lived as a boy almost 100 years ago.
The neighborhood swarmed with rats, cats, dogs, fortune tellers, cripples, blind men, whores, salesmen, rent collectors, and children. Smoke obscured the vision, and cinders drifted into the house, into our beds, into the kitchen, into our food. And a tar-like smell was always in the air.
That's an actor reading from Richard Wright's book, Black Boy. Just one generation later, Wright's daughter, Julia Wright, grew up in a very different world.
When I was 12 years old, my father and my mother had gone to the theater, and we were living in a beautiful apartment in Paris.
Richard Wright had moved the family to Paris in the late 40s. Julia Wright attended the Sorbonne. One night, she picked up her famous father's first book, based on his childhood in Mississippi, almost reluctantly.
And I went into my father's workroom and took Black Boy down from the shelf. I really didn't want to read it. I maybe would have preferred a mystery story or something. And then I went into the kitchen and took some chocolate caramels and went to bed with Black Boy and the chocolate caramels.
Here's some of what she read. By the time Wright was 12, he'd set fire to his mother's house. He'd been sent to an orphanage. He'd been lured into a Memphis bar and plied with liquor.
And when I got to the end of chapter 2 and I read that he only had an orange for Christmas and that he sucked it slowly to make it last, I spit the caramels out.
Richard Wright's story of his own childhood made him one of America's most popular writers in the 1940s. He wrote Black Boy, based on his own life, and Native Son, a fictional account of a black boy in the segregated North. Both were Book of the Month Club selections. The character Bigger Thomas, from Native Son, was an uneducated black man from Chicago who ends up killing a young white woman. Bigger is strong, ignorant, angry, but he's also confused, vulnerable, at a loss about how to deal with a racist society. Wright made Bigger Thomas, a black man, into America's native son, the offspring of a nation's bigotry.
Well, your father, of course, first became famous for publication of Native Son and then yes. Black Boy. The inscription in the copy of Black Boy that I'm holding is dedicated to Julia and Ellen. You were 3 years old when this book was first published.
I never knew it was dedicated to me. In fact, this was my father's position. He wanted us kids to discover who he was. He was not going to impose who he was on us.
Wright's message to the next generation, whether his own daughter or school kids, was simply found on the printed page. Julia Wright has spent this year, the centennial of Richard Wright's birth, talking about a new book her father was writing when he died. It's called A Father's Law, about the relationship between generations.
Let me ask you, Miss Wright, Richard Wright, your dad, had a very tense relationship with his own father. He returned a few times to Mississippi to see him, but by that time, Richard Wright had been living in Paris. His father was a sharecropper in Natchez. Did he ever talk to you about his father?
No, he did not have time, and he did not think I was mature enough, but he knew by then that I had been reading his books, and he waited for the questions. Whenever I asked, I got an answer. If I didn't ask, he would wait. What I see is we must allow our children to become who they are meant to be. Open the doors to them. Open the doors for them. Give them what we can. Give them books, the messages. These are things that will keep us together.
Richard Wright passed along the story of his life in his books. That world seems remote today, and those books aren't as widely read as they used to be.
You would be surprised about how many students don't know who Richard Wright really is. Actually, I'm 32 years old, and I didn't know who Richard Wright was before I started this documentary.
Latasha Wansley Clark is a student in Natchez, Mississippi. She was never much of a reader until she discovered that Richard Wright grew up nearby. To mark the centennial of his birth, the students at Copiah Lincoln Community College produced a documentary about Richard Wright's life and work.
And, oh my goodness, it changed my life. I read the book, and now I read books all the time now, more than I did before, because of the impact that it had on me. It's like you're there with him as he is going on his journey, and it was awesome.
Well, what had such impact on you? You said it changed your life. What made that impression?
Yeah, it really did. Well, because he as a child, he knew that he wanted to change the way people thought. As a child, the things that he went through as a child, the hunger, and you would think a lot when you read in the book, you would think, oh, he's hungry because he's not eating. He was hungry to get out and let people know really what was going on in Mississippi, what the African-American generation was going through in Black Boy.
The stories that one generation passes to another continues. One boy who read Richard Wright was the writer Walter Dean Myers.
What I wanted to show was a duality of character more clearly than Wright had. Because when I was a kid, if there was a fight, I would look for it, try to find it. But when I wasn't doing that, I was a book person.
Tomorrow, I'll speak with Myers as he tries to reach the next generation through his writing. Juan Williams, NPR News, Washington.
And you can read an excerpt of A Father's Law at NPR.org.
I am Netta Ulibi. This week on NPR's podcast, Book Tour, we'll hear from author Dick Meyer as he reads from his new book. It's called Why We Hate Us, American Discontent in the New Millennium. Meyer contrasts today's era of vulgar reality shows, rude drivers, soulless chain stores, and inconsiderate cell phone conversations with that of his parents' generation.
My father went to work for my mother's father, who ran the leather tannery on the north side of Chicago that his grandfather had started in 1892 and had operated in the same location until 2007. My dad worked there until the day before he died. My parents settled in Glencoe, the town right next to Highland Park, and then stayed put. My mother died before my grandmother and never lived more than a few miles away from her.
For the entire reading and discussion, and to hear other authors of fiction and nonfiction, please go to npr.org/booktour.
Groucho Marx once said, "Outside of a dog, a book is a man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read." Well, today we continue our series Three Books with a theme that Harpo's brother might appreciate. Science fiction writer Stephen Barnes recommended his favorite books about, maybe you guessed, dogs.
Man's best friend. We go way back. A science writer friend has a cocktail party theory that canines and human beings actually co-evolved. He likes to say that we made a deal with them to protect their puppies if they would lend us their noses. They became our furry, walking olfactory lobes, freeing our four brains to develop logic, spatial reasoning, and PlayStation 3. Maybe all that ancient history explains why we're so fascinated by our four-legged friends, why we laud and demonize them. I invite you to lie back in your hammock and enjoy the literary adventures of three very different doggies. In Stephen King's classic Cujo, a cheating wife is trapped in a broken-down car, assaulted by a rabid St. Bernard. King winks at the reader, as if to say, "Wanna bet I can't write a whole book set almost entirely in a car?" Trust me, he pulls it off. King knows what we love, which makes it easy to attack our hearts with our greatest fears, by playing to our terror of loss and betrayal, and wrapping those nightmares in 200 pounds of fang and fury. He delivers a genuinely jolting fright fest, a minor book by a major force in popular culture. Trotting back to the turn of the 19th century, we find the great detective himself, Sherlock Holmes. In The Hound of the Baskervilles, Holmes confronts a murderous demon dog avenging past wrongs. I suspect the book works because it echoes the complexities of the real-world human-canine relationship. Humanity domesticated wolves and bred them down to spaniels. On some deep and hidden level, do chihuahuas remember when we feared them rather than carried them in our purses? Do poodles ever wonder how we taste? We have an odd relationship with man's best friend, and on the moors of the Baskervilles, the ultimate man of logic meets the ultimate nightmare from our primeval past. The consequence is a timeless literary classic. Lastly, we come to one of my favorite guilty pleasures, Dean Koontz's Dragon Tears. This tale of a super-powered serial killer loose in Southern California is a nail-biter. Five ordinary human beings struggle to stop the birth of a new evil godling. The battle is horrendously uneven, but the humans have one unexpected advantage. Woofer, a wonderful mutt with a surprising non-human intelligence. It's Woofer's ability to perceive hidden emotion, his courageous, loyal heart, and ultimately, the uncanny canine sense of smell that gives these frail mortals and all humanity a bare chance of survival. When he rises above his humble origins to risk life and all four furry limbs for the men and women who have shown him simple kindness, I promise you will cheer. And there you have it, three terrific books with both bark and serious bite, the perfect way to wind down the dog days of summer.
Stephen Barnes is a science fiction writer. His upcoming book is called In the Night of the Heat. On the topic of dogs, his recommendations were Cujo by Stephen King, The Hound of the Baskervilles by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and Dragon Tears by Dean Koontz. You can find more three book suggestions at npr.org.
They may be overshadowed by the internet, but books still have the power to change a life. That's true of the man we're about to meet. Books also have the power to help people pass on stories from one generation to the next, and that is what happened to Walter Dean Myers. He grew up reading the works of the writer we heard about on this program yesterday, Richard Wright. Now, Myers himself wants to reach Black and Hispanic kids. NPR's Juan Williams continues his reporting on how one generation of Black Americans tells its stories to the next.
They meet in a classroom at a juvenile detention center in the South Bronx. The kids walk in wearing prison jumpsuits, hands behind their backs. They sit slumped in their chairs. But don't be fooled by the attitude. These kids have been required to read some of Walter Dean Myers' dozens of books. Books about being insecure for lack of a dad. books about being scared to walk in your own neighborhood, books about being viewed as a criminal monster. So they want to be there to meet the author. An NPR producer sat in.
So I write, and I've been writing for 30 years. And whatever interests me is what I write about, right?
Walter Dean Myers had his share of run-ins with the law growing up. He lived not far from this Bronx detention center with his adopted family in Harlem. One girl, her name is Brittany, says she found family in prison.
And, you know, you think more when you're locked up. You think more positive.
Sometimes when you're on the street, you don't do that.
You be in the house, as soon as you hang out late, and you see how fun it is, you get addicted to it, and you want to keep coming out late and later and later. Now look where I'm at.
Yeah.
Or because I got addicted to stupid stuff, like addicted to things that even teach me how to be smarter. I might be a little bit street smart, but I'm not book smart.
Right. One of the things that you can do is to start writing, because you're saying things that people want to hear. You're saying things that you have realized upon reflection. Maybe you'll want to do a book outline, and I can help you with it. If you're interested, I am.
One way the 70-year-old Walter Dean Myers gets interested in his books is to map out the characters. He uses photographs.
I started collecting photographs because I did a writing workshop in a school in Jersey City, and the kids are writing such negative stuff about themselves that I began to collect photographs to show how beautiful they actually were. And I used the photographs in a number of different books.
He pulled out one of his books. On the back cover, there's a picture of him with his brother in front of the church they went to as kids. The kids at the detention center gathered around quickly to look.
Which one of those is me?
Just that one, yeah.
Yep.
Let me see Brittany. Look at
that. Who's that boy next to you?
My brother. One of my brothers.
Today, Walter Dean Myers lives across the river from his Harlem roots, among a collection of tens of thousands of photographs depicting various aspects of African-American life.
I have cabinets throughout the house full of photographs.
I sat across from him in his Jersey City home office, and he showed me some of the pictures he's collected.
This is 1901 or something like that. These are children in these regular public schools.
These are white kids.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes black kids. This is actually the school I went to as a child.
Walter Dean Myers grew up in Harlem with the parents who adopted him. He was tall, teased for his speech impediment, and got into his share of fights. Off the streets, he had a secret life. He read books. Around that time in the 1950s, he discovered a writer who he could see right around the corner in Harlem, a writer named Langston Hughes.
As a kid, I wanted to be a writer. Now, all my models were British writers. This is what I learned in school. So when I met Langston Hughes, he didn't look to me like a writer.
Because he wasn't white.
Because he wasn't white.
Did you ever read Richard Wright?
Yes.
And did you read Black Boy?
Yes. Actually, I got to Richard Wright through James Baldwin. James Baldwin and Richard Wright had this clash, and I met James Baldwin, and I asked him about that clash, and he was saying that when he read Black Boy, he was both pleased with it because it mirrored some of the things that had happened to him, but he was upset with it because he felt that Wright had glamorized, in a sort of a negative way, his earlier upbringing.
Glamorized black criminal activity.
Right. So when I'm writing Bad Boy, I'm thinking to myself, I don't want to glamorize anything that I've done. What I wanted to show was a duality of character, more clearly than Wright had. Because when I was a kid, I would be in the streets, I'd play ball. If there was a fight, I would look for it. But when I wasn't doing that, I was a book person.
Bad Boy, the story of his early life, does not glamorize the fights. But Walter Dean Myers didn't reveal everything in his memoir.
What would you put into that story if you had the opportunity to rewrite your life story again?
I think I would have put in more about the burden I carried with me every single day. First time I dropped out of school, the counselors asked me what was wrong. And I couldn't say that, you know, my home life was disintegrating. I wasn't going to go tell some teacher, oh, no, well, you know, my mom's an alcoholic and this is... I wasn't going to do that. I had a knock on my door and someone said to me, Walter, your mother's downstairs in the hallway. You better, you know, go down, carry her upstairs. For 2 days after that, I couldn't think of anything. But I think that weighed on me so much.
Walter Dean Myers understands that there must be a lot weighing on the minds of the kids at that Bronx detention facility. The kids who had slouched in the chairs when he first started speaking leaned in to listen. One of the girls said, she writes. Walter Dean Myers asked the group,
if you could tell me to write a book, what would it be about?
You're doing it already, about life. Just life.
About life. Just life, she said. Juan Williams, NPR News.
You can get a look at some of the photos that inspired Walter Dean Myers' writing, and you can read the first chapter of his book, Game, at NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
When they write the book about the rhetorical achievements of George W. Bush, one turn of phrase deserves its own chapter. It was January 2002, and during the State of the Union, the president linked the countries of Iraq, Iran, and North Korea with this now famous sentence.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world.
At Callahan's Diner in Santa Monica, California, a foreign policy analyst, Chris Fair, was eating pancakes and watching the speech. She traveled extensively around the regions that Mr. Bush was describing, and she just couldn't get over those words, axis of evil.
I am a professional analyst of South Asia. It was pretty clear to me that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda had nothing to do with any of those three countries named.
Chris Fair thought this could be a recipe for international disaster. Then she just started to think about the recipe part.
I'm a food-obsessed person. I think about food all the time. Also, I cook when I get depressed.
If President Bush could link Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, then so would she. What emerged was a cookbook, Cuisines of the Axis of Evil, a dinner party approach to international relations. The book is half foreign policy and half menu planning, kind of a Martha Stewart meets Henry Kissinger thing. You learn that Asian pear is the secret to a great North Korean bulgogi. And you can digest that along with a list of the human rights offenses of Kim Jong-il. The history of Saddam Hussein's quest for weapons of mass destruction is just as spicy as the okra and lamb stew. Bam!
In the course of my travels, I've become really acclimatized to the politics of food, be it the really simple things like how the food is produced and who does it and who gets to eat it, whether or not the country has food at all. So I think using the cookbook and using food to really express my various degrees of analytical and personal frustration came very natural to me.
All this talk of terrorism and oppressive regimes can make someone hungry. Luckily, Chris Fair invited us to one of her Axis of Evil dinner parties here in Washington, D.C. While Fair was writing the book, she would invite friends and diplomats over to test out the recipes and debate international politics. On this night, the buffet was Iranian.
We have a dish that's supposed to be karafsh, which is traditionally made of celery. And Iranians have a particularly unique ingredient that they use in dishes like that. It's basically a dried lime. It gives it this really fine sour/bitter taste. It's very distinctive.
At the party, you could see the crazy logic of digestive diplomacy. It's much more difficult to start a war with Iran after tasting their version of the dessert baklava. One of the guests at the party was won over. Sarah Taylor works for the National Zoo.
Well, if it is evil, it's the best tasting evil I've ever tasted. It tastes like honey and cinnamon and pistachios, and it's delicious.
That's why Chris Fair says, at its heart, this cookbook isn't just a joke.
One of the interesting symbols of nationalism is food. We often don't think about it, but think about the efforts, for example, in New Orleans to resurrect their cuisine after Hurricane Katrina. Think about how much France goes about protecting, you know, something as simple as a French baguette.
You're a foreign policy analyst, and I'm going to trust you on some of these brainy issues. But what about the food? I mean, how do I know that this stuff actually tastes good? You know, you talk a good game on foreign policy, but
Let's talk cuisines. How'd you learn how to do this?
Well, again, you know, I'm a nut about food. And part of it is just triangulation. I'll go to a country, I'll eat something, I'll try to find a recipe either online or I'll try to talk to someone about how they make it or certainly from a cookbook. And I am pretty shameless, you know. I'll just go, hey, waiter, you know, I'm trying to make this particular chapli kebab and I can't get it quite right. What's your secret? And, you know, they're actually very forthcoming, often whispering, you know, whether managers aren't paying attention.
Sounds a lot like our intelligence agencies, the United States.
I like to think of myself as a culinary spook.
Chris Fair is a foreign policy analyst and a former political affairs officer for the United Nations. She's the author of Cuisines of the Axis of Evil, published by the Lions Press. Thanks for coming in.
No, thank you for having me.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.